on the agenda is a briefing on vertical infrastructure in the right-of-way and cellular antennas. And we have some representatives from PBOT, BPS, and BDS here to discuss that. Welcome.
Great. I'll invite PBOT and BPS to the table to introduce themselves.
Hi, my name is Ann Hill. I work at the Portland Bureau of Transportation in the program development.
Hi, Christine Kendrick, Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, working with Smart Cities, Open Data, and Air Quality. I'm going to start off today's presentation giving you some background on vertical infrastructure in the right-of-way and cellular antennas, and then Ann will continue the discussion, focus on our immediate design needs and implementation needs.
Christina? Yeah, let me do it. That's perfect. Can I interrupt for 1 second?
Oh, sorry, Tim.
No.
Jumping in.
So as you could tell, Christina is ready to go because we've given this briefing before the Design Commission on March 1st, so last month and a couple days ago. So you're kind of getting a similar shtick with a little bit of historic focus, but essentially the same issues before you. Over the weekend or this morning, I forget which, I forwarded you a summary memo from the that I put together from that Design Commission briefing. You all should have copies of that. Let me know if you don't or haven't had a chance to read that. And that just kind of went through a very quick synopsis of kind of what the Design Commission agreed to or thought was appropriate per PBOT's presentation. And it went really well. It was a good collaborative process. So I'm really, really happy on the way this PowerPoint came together. It's a pretty intense bunch of infrastructure coming down the road, so to speak, pardon the pun. So without any further ado, I would turn it over.
Thank you. Thank you for the introduction. So the problem that we're here to talk to you about today is the rapidly growing demand for wireless and data services. This is contributed to by the growth of wireless devices, automated systems, and data needs. And this growing demand increases pressure on two of Portland's finite resources, the public right-of-way and also city-owned poles in the right-of-way. And our existing policies and guidelines do not address the needs and constraints of today and for the future. So this increasing demand cannot be served by the traditional large macro cell towers that we're more used to seeing. And because of that, cellular and wireless providers are looking to install and expand networks of small cell systems, which can improve the reliability and capacity of our cellular networks in dense urban areas. Small cells are also referred to sometimes as distributed antenna systems or DAS systems. They're short-range, low-powered cellular radio access. But they're called small not because of their actual physical size, really to describe their shorter range and that they can handle fewer calls and sessions with this infrastructure. And this image just shows you some comparison, the macro cell connecting to the small cell and the different range and distance that these two different types of cellular infrastructure can serve. On this next slide, we tried to come up with draw a comparison between the macro cell and small cell sites. A traditional macro cell tower can range from 30 to 250 feet, so really large range of height, contains a lot of climate controlled bases or power supply and backup equipment, either in the base or in additional sheds and equipment next to the macro cell tower. Small cells, the height can vary, but they need to be tall enough to fill in that coverage. So typically they are installed on streetlights. Pictured here is a very simple example of a well-camouflaged small cell site. But again, there's a lot of variability in the size of the antenna, the size of the radio relay unit, the equipment in the base or underground, and this can vary depending on the company. The important things to note here are that the antenna has to be above ground, so not everything can go underground. Like, it is kind of a very thin pole camouflaged here, then a lot of equipment's underground. And also that different carriers cannot currently be on the same pole. So each small cell site needs its own pole. This is due to some spectrum issues and other FCC requirements. So thinking about City of Portland and the FCC requirements, we know we have at least four local carriers. We will need at least hundreds of poles in the city, and most of these will be concentrated downtown. And we have actually recently gotten more of a current estimate on that number, and we're seeing something like 2,400 small cell sites in for the city of Portland, with the majority in the downtown district. So thinking about those numbers, if we look at our downtown and underground wiring districts, there are not enough traffic signal and streetlight poles in downtown. Also thinking about this equipment will require replacements and upgrades in the poles, but we still have many needs for connectivity. Every person, every vehicle at a minimum has one cellular device each. We need emergency access for connectivity. And again, the federal requirements to allow for this connectivity and capacity. So over the past year, we worked in a multi-agency work group and this strategic framework was provided in your materials for today's briefing. This framework started to summarize our problems, understand our limitations, what are the opportunities here as well, and how can we start to create that centralized proactive management strategy so that we can not only meet our own connectivity needs, but also continue to proactively manage the right-of-way and the assets in the right-of-way. Some of our main findings from this framework and continuing in this work group, really the main theme is that vertical infrastructure right now in the city of Portland is currently underutilized. It's really single use only. Streetlight is just to provide light, no multiple uses. But there are a lot of pools and needs occurring in the right of way. So this model is not really sustainable with its increasing growing demands and needs. So we did identify opportunities. We right now do have the opportunity to set our own aesthetic and noise mitigation requirements. We can potentially increase investments in our infrastructure and upgrade our infrastructure. But then how do we still manage that to have equitable deployment of these services? And that aesthetic and noise mitigation piece is really important, as we can see here, trying to emphasize why that camouflage and concealment is a priority. These examples are from actual small cell sites deployed in California. We see lots of exposed wires, multiple boxes and cabinets that are very large on the pole, and also noise generating fans. With all this equipment, there can also be a lot of designs that have intrusive right-of-way cabinets and support equipment. The picture on the right is from an actual small cell deployment in Woodbridge, Virginia. So these are things that we're trying to work to make sure don't happen in Portland.
I'm going to talk a little bit about what we're seeing in Portland. This right here shows current installations of cellular equipment. They're not small cell equipment, but they are related to the carriers on utility-owned poles in the right-of-way. And as you can see, these poles, you can see the boxes, there's not much shrouding. One of these instances, there have been reports that it's quite loud, again, because of the fans. So we would be looking to transfer any updates that we would make to code or our guidelines to ideally help those future installations on those third-party poles through some of our franchise agreements. This right here, we're going to move now to sort of what can we do? What are some solutions? And these are examples. I believe they're in San Francisco. These are examples in San Francisco of streamlined installations of small cells with streetlights. As you can see, the antennas at the top and the rest of the equipment, for the most part, is in underground vaults. And that's what keeps some of those poles quite narrow at the, and there's not a big base at the bottom. So moving equipment to vaults is possible with regulation and policy. This is another example of a signal pole. This is a photo simulation, of course, to Portland. And as you can see, with the 2,400 locations that are estimated that will be necessary here in the city, there aren't enough traffic poles to place these on. But that's absolutely where we can start. And so as you can see here, you see the again, the antenna at the top, and then that's the radio frequency. I'm looking to relay. The radio relay is that second piece right there. And again, here's another example. Again, a simulation for Portland, but you can see the rendering where a lot of the equipment is in that underground vault area. So those are just design examples, things that we would be looking at. So because, of course, ornamentals are the majority of the poles in the right-of-way in the downtown and in the city center, they will be looked at for attachments. Because they don't have 24/7 power and they're structurally not strong enough, either replacements would be considered or adding additional poles, which I'll talk about in a minute. So here are several examples of new versions. So you can see the original version in the smaller picture. This is in Maryland. And then the example of a new version that accommodates the small cell. This one's in Maryland. I'm not sure where the green one is, but as you can see there, I know there's been concern about that base. The base is quite larger in that other example. So here's an example. This is quite similar. This is our catenary pole, which is already something that we see here in Portland, a catenary pole that's been combined with an ornamental. And the rendering there, of course, is just a drawing of some of the solutions that cities have come up with across the country. As I said, catenary poles will be considered. But again, if we started with traffic signal poles and then moved to catenary, lights are going to be looked at as sort of a third option. When we start addressing the sites. So standalone poles, this is something that other cities, as you can see that first drawing, they have these two street lights, and then they have the pole that is what's called a monopole. It's there just for the small cell. There's another example in a city, I believe, I'm not sure where that other picture is. Do you know, Christine? We don't have the location of that, the second one there. This is not something that the Bureau of Transportation is necessarily supporting, mostly because we have so much in our right-of-way already. And so it would just be yet another object. But this is something that other cities have looked at to supplement things like ornamentals. So when we think about the hierarchy of camouflaging when available, we are looking at focusing on utilitarian poles, so not single-use poles. Traffic signal poles first, then catenary, and then ornamental light fixtures. So examples in the downtown or the auditorium district are two examples of where those light fixtures are. And for all the pole options, we are looking at supporting equipment in vault spaces. The second would be larger bases, and the third would be a cabinet in the right-of-way. So we really don't want cabinets in the right-of-way as an option. We want to start with the underground vaults. So the other thing we just wanted to raise was, as we've been talking about this and sort of peeling the onion of this new technology and the implications of what it means in the right-of-way, we are also encouraging those responsible for future planning to look at some of these considerations in the future so that we don't end up having to, sort of cite or specify designs that then have to be either pulled up or something else supplemented, but that we can actually look for solutions in the future with some of our new developments that come in. And then finally, what we're here for is to really ask for your help in sort of thinking through all of these different elements. So vertical infrastructure being currently underutilized. We are looking at amending the code to help move forward with multi-use planning for city-owned poles in the right-of-way. We are up against some of the FCC requirements and the discussions around preemption, which would just mean that we wouldn't have any choice about what we wanted to see happen. And in an effort to get in front of this, we, the Portland Bureau of Transportation, we have entered a contract, or we're negotiating a contract for what's called a wireless master plan to help us sort of plan the use and have a master lease agreement around some of these deployments. So we would like your support to create the most proactive policy for our right-of-way and really focus on that aesthetic and noise mitigation. And at this point, we would just like to open it up for discussion and answer any questions you have.
If I may, before we begin, I would like to disclose that I work for CenturyLink, which is a carrier governed by the FCC. We do not have a wireless business. Therefore, I don't think this impacts us at all. But a lot of the types of equipment that you see in the rights of way are CenturyLink or former US West boxes and whatnot. So I'll just mention that.
I'll start with a question.
Sure.
I can't remember if it was Christina or Anne, but yeah. One of you mentioned that each provider has to have their own equipment on their own pole, mm-hmm. Which really struck me. That puts us in a tough position, obviously, because there are how many carriers mm-hmm. working in the city of Portland? So I guess to follow up on that, I wanted to hear a little bit about the various sort of types of equipment that they use, and are all of them roughly the same size, or are there carriers that have equipment that is larger? You know, how can we sort of create size standards for this mm-hmm. stuff?
You can jump in too, Christine. So from what we understand, each of the carriers, there's four carriers. So when we came up with the number 2400, what we've been told is that the sort of standard is you need one small cell per 1,000 people. So if there's 600,000 people in Portland, right, that's 600 times four carriers, that's 2400. And those would roll out over like 3 to 4 years, right? So they can't be on the same pole for a variety of reasons. One, though, is the spectrum. So those antennas, it's not like the one antenna can't serve four different carriers. So they each have these antennas and they each have frequencies, and the frequencies are different. You might know a little bit just from CenturyLink. So tell me if I'm wrong, because I'm learning this as I go.
You're doing great.
Thank you. So for that reason, they have to be on different separate poles. Or that they have to have their own single location. They all do have their own designs, right? Each carrier has their own equipment and their own designs. But what we have seen across the country, and most of the carriers are quite willing to work with cities, they have come up with, I think it was Lincoln, Nebraska, like everything had to fit within they had like some dimension. And what they chose to do when it came to shrouding was they have banners. If you think about like the banners we have like on the, you know, different poles around the city, right? So it had to fit within sort of that space, right? And for the most part, the carriers are fine. Now, if you don't have requirements, then of course the carriers are happy to put up their proprietary equipment because it's easy, right? But we've seen a number of examples of the carriers being fine with working within those regulations or the requirements that a city sets.
Okay. And do they pay for all this, or are we paying for it?
For the most part, so with the wireless master plan, of course, we haven't talked to any of the carriers, but what we've seen is that for the most part, all of our poles would have to be replaced, whether we're talking signal poles or whether we're like the traffic signal poles or whether we were talking lights. And for a variety of reasons, one is that there's not enough conduit. They might not be structurally sound enough to hold, right, the equipment. Our understanding is that the carriers are, because they need to get these built, they're working with the cities in doing things like replacing poles. And then it's their equipment that they lease the space off of the pole for.
So they pay us or the city for
yes.
being able to use the poles.
Yes.
And then they will help prepare whatever object you're
yes.
attaching to be appropriate per whatever you're
yes. doing. So there, what happens is a utility comes in and they get a franchise agreement. So CenturyLink has franchise agreements, AT&T, Mobility, they have franchise agreements. Then the next step is if they're going to go to a third-party pole, so most of the poles, let's say on Hawthorne, are all owned by PGE that we have our lights on, then they would go to PGE and they would apply for whatever they needed to apply to lease the space on that pole. They would come back here to the city to transportation to get a permit, right, to permit mm-hmm. working in the right-of-way. If they are back at the franchise, if they want to attached to a city-owned pole, and right now all the poles in the downtown are only owned by the city of Portland, they would then come to the Bureau of Transportation and we would have a lease, and we're we're going to do that through this company, Fibars, would have a master lease agreement. They would lease the pole, and then they would still go to get their permit, because the permit is allowing them to do that work in the right of way. So then they would pay a lease, a yearly lease.
And I'll just add, as part of that lease agreement, there'd be design specifications. That's where we would have them, that.
Right. So they would meet those design specs.
So they are trying to please us in the sense.
Absolutely.
That,
right, okay. Yes. I mean, our understanding is that the utilities are, you know, their goal is they want to get their builds done, right? They want to get their, they need to get ready for what we keep hearing about the 5G, right? So they want the most streamlined, most efficient path to get their deployments out
they
the door.
They have regulatory obligations to get this done, and so it would behoove them to comply with whatever we want to impose.
That was my question, because my phone works great all the time in downtown, so why do we need more? And that was the question, is really, they're telling us we need all this equipment. Do we really need it?
It's actually, I don't think them as much as the FCC. Oh,
okay.
Sorry.
Well, and I would say, you know, people, we cite the Women's March as an example. A lot of people talked about the Women's March, you couldn't get your signal, like you couldn't get on your phone because there were so many people downtown that were trying, that there wasn't enough distribution. So what's happening is, as we have more and more and more things happening with our phones, or you're paying for parking and you're paying for TriMet and you can download watching your house from your phone and what's going on with your alarms, right? All that stuff, the more that we're doing that, the more space there needs to be able to get those signals out. And so the downtown is where it's going to be the most dense. That's where there's the most people, the most activity. So
And I would just add that we're using a lot of that technology for emergency services now. And it would be really tragic if we couldn't get signals out to people, because when I say we, I mean whoever the emergency people are, but they couldn't get the signals out to whomever needs to get them. So I will say that I don't think it's a money-making thing on behalf of the carriers. I think they're being forced to do it by the FCC because of the safety reasons.
Well, I would hope that they would have reserved a certain amount of bandwidth just for emergencies. So that
they do. Mm-hmm.
So
they
it's not, they wouldn't be necessarily competing with the kind of the run-of-the-mill people watching soccer and stuff like that.
What's interesting is that not every jurisdiction has text to 911, for instance, and they decide on their own whether or not they want that. So in some jurisdictions, you know, you're talking about the 911 frequencies through the phone. You know, that's been deemed to be something everybody should be able to call, you know, if you need help. Mm. But what's happening more and more is that, particularly if you're in a situation where you're not at a phone, like a landline phone, and you need help, people are trying to text 911, but it's not a requirement yet by the FCC that they be allowed to. But I think that people are using it. And so the concern is, particularly if we wind up with a seismic event, you want to be able to communicate that to everybody, even if they're not at a phone. So anyway. There you go. Sorry.
All right. Thank
you. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, I had a question just about the evolution of technology over time. Mm-hmm. I mean, the small cell technology has been out for a little while now, and there have been a number of exemptions already within federal law, at least as it applies to historic resources. I think there's a program comment out there for Section 106 of the National Historic Preservation Act, which exempted a lot of these facilities from consideration. But I've also been privy to a number of different ways you can design a system that can avoid a lot of these issues of capacity in terms of having trunk fiber optic lines, for instance, and fewer, I don't know, exact word for it, but basically fewer towers as a result. Mm-hmm. So you can carry more capacity on these basically underground wires or visible wires on poles. And I wanted to just get your feedback on that, because by the time we implement this program and everybody does their facilities, there's some idea that some of this technology would just go away.
I don't know, Christine, if you know anything about the underground. Understanding it, what we've talked about from the very beginning with the framework is that, you know, even though the small cells are right now the first, it's by no means going to be the last. When we're looking at AV, automated vehicles, connected vehicles, I don't even know what's coming next. I don't know where drones are going to go. I mean, the poles, multi-purpose infrastructure is going to be something, especially vertical, that's going to have to be looked at. And so we are hoping, our intent with these poles is that the design requirements are going to have things like, you know, make sure that we have additional capacity for, let's say, fiber or conduit, or that there's additional plugins, because what if we want safety cameras, or what if we want like the speed cameras, right? So depending on what's coming, climate sensors, that they would not just be for one use, understanding that you're right, in 10 years, like they might say, oh, we don't need these anymore, and they're going to take them away, but we could use those poles with electricity for other uses. I don't know, Christine, if you can talk about the...
Well, I think I would just also add in how to design a new pole so that there are enough extra power connections, fiber connections. Can we eventually then use them for public Wi-Fi or other types of technology that come along the lines if things change? But then also, how do you create mounts that are built into the pole so that if we do have an additional equipment that the city wants to deploy, you can install it on there without having to do bands? And again, thinking about that aesthetics so it would be streamlined.
Do you know anything about the first question about building? I don't know anything about building underground versus the small cell.
Just having your fiber optic lines underground that would have more capacity to carry signals between.
You mean fiber?
I think that gets, because I mean,
fiber
can't,
to cell, yeah.
And also do municipal fiber networks. There's limitations on that. So it's still, you know, 5G and small cell sites aren't going to go away even within the next 10 years with technology changing.
I think that Commissioner Ranzetta's comment, though, is important because, you know, although we don't have a CenturyLink doesn't have a wireless business, we do a lot of fiber to the cell for the reasons that Chair Ranzetta mentioned. So to obviate the need for a lot of small cell technology mm-hmm. requirements in central cities. I think that, so I agree, I think that at some point when all of that is built out, there may be a smaller need, but at the moment the FCC has mandated this, it sounds like so many per carrier, so I don't know that, I think that it won't be a market-based decision. I think it'll be a regulatory decision.
I have my colleague, Alex Bejarano, manages the utility. When I talked about utility permits, he has a comment.
Thank you. Alex Bejarano, PBOT. I manage utilities construction inspection, so we do all the permitting for all the franchise utilities, inspection of those, what have you. The downtown core is a very congested underground as well. So as we look to... we don't have a requirement to put anything underground, but most carriers in this realm don't want to be underground because there's no place to put them. And so what we'd be talking about is having to relocate other utilities or consolidate over utilities over, you know, the last century of people putting things in. There's just not a lot of room to go underground with more capacity.
Is there a master plan that's currently in place that where the city actually knows for certain where all the utilities are located and in terms of understanding what that capacity actually is, as opposed to?
Yes, we do. So downtown in the core is a very good example. So we've had records for probably the early 20s, early 10s, that are actually utility boards that were hand-drawn, watercolored in. They're beautiful pieces of art, actually. Mm-hmm. Nerdy, but you know, but very pretty. And so we have a very good idea of where those are at, and then we've continued to keep those records up in the downtown core especially.
So, I mean, in terms of a master plan?
So there is no master plan. The right-of-way is opened up through franchises to allow the utility to place their facilities in the right-of-way. And then it's a first-come, first-served basis. So we don't reserve rights-of-way and say utilities are here in that capacity. So it's really, if a utility wants to come in underground, they need to find that, weave that way through the right-of-way. And there's restrictions and standards on that, of course, but where they can go. You know, for example, there's a number of streets here that people have to go 20, 30 feet down if they need to get underneath everybody else so they can have a clear running line. So it's very expensive to do so.
Okay. Well, I'm seeing kind of some conflict between what's going in above ground and what's going in below ground, because no matter what you put above ground, you've got to put something below ground as well. So what I'm hearing is that there's, at least for some component of the utility, there's a hampering of capacity. But for our streetlights, at least, you could throw as much as you want on there. But I still feel like there's, I mean, in terms of electrical capacity, at least you have to increase the amount of electricity that you're going to have to feed these facilities, obviously, because they don't just operate on their own.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the reasons we had a few years ago, Google was going to come to town. One of the reasons they pulled out is because undergrounding utilities is so expensive. They're starting to look, and they're looking in San Francisco and other areas to actually go pole mounted and do all their communications wireless. And so they're able to utilize the existing power and then utilize these facilities above ground so that they don't have to trench.
And those are some of the things that they are discussing with the FCC. So just like other things that have become regulated, that's why we've come to you now, because we're up against sort of a, I mean, at any moment, the FCC could say, preempt and just say, you, it doesn't matter what your ornamental poles are, doesn't matter what your streetlights are. This is a, you know, we have to do this in the name of emergency communications, et cetera, that we get to put what we want to put in your right of way. So we are working to conscientiously work sort of proactively to come up with some solutions, meeting their needs, and then also, you know, working to meet ours as well.
I have a question about, I have no idea about this. I'm wondering if you do. Are there historic ornamental fixtures out there, and does PBOT have a inventory of those?
So yeah, so most of the, if you think about when you're downtown in Portland, I don't know if we can get back, the majority of the, well, all of the ornamentals, so these sort of up on your screen right now, those are called, those are the ornamental streetlights. Those are, most of them are cast iron, I believe. Tim can speak, or some of you that have been on the commission for a while. And those have all been historic lights. The problem with those lights, they're fine as standalone structures. You can't multi-use them for a variety of reasons.
So what you've been describing is that they need to be replaced in order to accommodate the new.
They're either going to need to be replaced, and then if they're replaced, with what? So that was one of the interesting conversations that came out of the design commission, was we don't want a fake historic. Why don't we just get the best new design, which what was one? Two, we want to leave, some cities have left their ornamentals completely alone, but then you have to have more poles, right? Because you, so the options isn't going to be, you can't put anything on any, like you can't touch any of these, because we're going to have to put them someplace 30 feet up in the right of way, right? So that's sort of the question today. And yes, we can start with signal traffic light poles, and yes, we can go to catenaries, but then once we hit those, which aren't going to be close to what we're going to need, we're then going to have to move to other poles. And most of those poles in the downtown are the ornamentals.
And I, maybe there's a way to prioritize the historic fabric over, you know, somehow strategize for that, and especially in historic districts. I'm not sure if that's a possibility or if something you've thought about.
That's why we're here. I'm sort of deferring a little bit to Tim as your staff. But, I mean, part of why we're here is to just sort of hear your thoughts and concerns and see what we can take back in good faith to come up with some options. One of the things that we're thinking of doing is, in collaboration with BDS and then BPS, Planning and Sustainability, is to potentially do like an RFI and ask for designs from either design companies, like designers in town, and or fabricators of these poles, to come up with like what's your best and your brightest with some requirements, and get back some options that we can then review as one option.
I think there's a variety of different types of lighting, like the just in the back here, the Halperin sequence has their own set of unique light standards. And then we have, you know, the cast iron ones downtown. There may be some Cobra lights that are out and around too. And maybe that's what you could look at, is to prioritize those, or, you know, the most recent types of lighting mechanisms. And then these, you know, it is a part of the city's legacy that's, you know, been intact for you know, since the 1880s. Now, granted, not all of these are from the 1880s. I mean, obviously some of them are newer, but nonetheless, they are a part of the streetscape. And a lot of these streetscapes have been modified over time to accommodate, for instance, in this situation, you know, some of the catenary poles and also stations for transportation. But and maybe we should be looking at prioritizing them, you know, away from historic districts or from some of the more historic areas of the city that maybe aren't designated necessarily. I was just going to say
the same thing, because a lot of downtown proper is not designated. So I would like to expand that priority to historic districts, historically designated properties, but also, you know, if I don't know if, say, the one that's on the screen is do these things get individually designated? No, right? So we don't even know whether or not
if you were in San Francisco, they actually are their own little historic resource.
There are a few in Old Town that are earlier. I think they're the old gas style ones that were converted. And I think those are actually quite old. Yeah. So most of these, I think you could buy reproductions today to match these. So
I do think that we should prioritize both those, the ones like in Old Town that are old gas in the historic district, as well as ones that are part of the iconic, you know, historic streetscape of downtown, which I'm sure are not designated in some way.
And I'll just interject, it sounds like what we're talking about is some sort of an inventory, just to understand, you know, an inventory. I know, but
don't even use that word.
To have an understanding, because maybe, you know, and then start prioritizing, you know, where, what's important, you know, where, and then go to the districts. And then the last would be the less historic in the non-historic areas. Yep. But I completely concur, you know, it's part of the historic fabric. It's not just a light fixture. And in many of them in our terrible shape, it'd be nice also to take it another step and maybe do some repairs, you know? I mean, if we can push the... these companies, I mean, maybe we can get something good for the city, not just sort of having to gut out another thing on our, you know, what we're looking at.
Can I follow up on that? Because I want to add, we keep talking about these things as poles, and I think we have a great opportunity, and I really like what you guys are doing, because you're thinking about the visual kind of pollution of our sort of streetscape, and a lot of it is stop, don't go this way, no left turn, da-da-da-da. So it becomes so overwhelming that as you're going down the street, you can hardly digest all that. And so when you showed that little town shot, we didn't know what town it was, but I was thinking the historic photo of that town has street poles with wires and big electrical stuff hanging all over it. And over time, all that went away. And now the poles are coming back. And so we have this opportunity to think about them better than we did the first time when we just sort of let it happen as the wood poles. Sorry. And I'm just getting excited about this idea of, you know, maybe each neighborhood could design their pole like a totem, or maybe it's a kiosk, or maybe it's maybe in a historic district, they're little informational poles that, you know, it's 3,000 miles to wherever this way or something, so that they start to serve multiple purposes and also become identifying neighborhood things. So like Division Street, they put the little profiles of the cutout bicycles. Think about it as an opportunity to, you know, create an identifying thing rather than something we're trying to make go away. It could actually be something that could be celebrated, like the little neighborhood library loaner boxes, or, you know, any type of situation where you have a public thing that has to be in the right of way, we'll surround it with a, you know, an informational board or some other purpose, and then we don't have to look at it in a bad way. So, anyway.
But and really quickly, the adding pole versus replacement of pole and making it look kind of like historic, it seems to me, and I think you guys would concur, that a fake historic replacing the historic with new that looks historic is less preferable than to keeping the historic and then adding, correct? Yeah,
I would.
Definitely.
I would agree. Because it seems like a lot of the ornamental is kind of going away. A lot of the traditional dimensions and kind of the appearance of the original goes away as a result of it. So it's almost like you might as well just start off with something new.
So that's a
clean and, yeah.
That's a good point. I Kurt, I understand we do have testifiers. And this feels like we're getting into more kind of deliberation. No, that's fine. Because I think that's a good point. So I don't want to stop that. I want to pick that up. But I think now would be a good time probably to listen to the testifiers so we have a full deliberation based on testimony as well. Good.
Okay. Thank you for the presentation.
Thank you.
I do have two folks who are here to testify. I have Meredy Pabst and Rich Roche. So your name's correct. And just state your name and address for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Meredy Pabst. I'm with Wireless Policy Group here today on behalf of AT&T. And Rich Roach is also with me here today, and I will just speak for both of us. AT&T is interested in and supportive of the city's adoption of new standards to regulate its installation of small cell facilities in the right-of-way. We're hoping that this process can get started quickly with some draft regulations to which we can respond, and we look forward to participating in the process going forward. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. All right. Does anyone else wish to testify on this particular item? Okay. With that, do we want to engage in some discussion in terms of the types of recommendations we could provide PBOT in terms of this proposal as it moves forward?
I just wanted to support Commissioner Foti's suggestion that we we do not prefer faux historic replacement and would prefer if there was a historic pole that needed to be, or that we needed some capacity somewhere, that we add a pole. I also wanted to support Commissioner Roman's comments. And in Eugene, have you seen those bike stations that they have on the poles where you can fix your flat tire, you can pump you can pump your tire, you can...
They have tools that are
They have little tools that are attached. Yeah, it's kind of cool. Anyway, maybe that would, I don't know, with PBOT and the bike thing, the program, if there might be some synergies or ability to, you know, coordinate that as we talk about adding multi-use poles.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. Ernestina?
Yeah, I was just going to add that it may be also... I don't know if that's something that is part of that, but with TriMet and some of the bus stops and some of those that are pretty much in every other block, especially downtown, there will be some structures within that, the bus stops or the MACs that could be used within that infrastructure.
Yeah, I'd offer that maybe that's a good time to bring PBOT back to the table. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know obviously with the catenary poles, there's already work with TriMet. I don't know about additional structures. They may not be tall enough, but it'll be that's an interesting thought.
The bus shelters, most of those aren't tall enough. They need to be about, because I was even thinking of pedestrian poles, but they're not tall enough. And just talking to Alex, we can, the issue with the monopoles, especially downtown, is that there's not enough space. Like, there's literally not enough room underneath. So if you're thinking Chinatown, you know, some of those areas, there's not enough room to put yet another pole physically. And there isn't potentially enough space underneath because some of those buildings come all the way out. You know, the basements come out all the way under the sidewalk. And just depending on what's going on in those buildings underneath the sidewalk, can you or can you not put a vault? So recommendations are recommendations, but just that's some of the stuff that we're, you know, of course it's not, none of this is happening out where there's space, right? It's all happening in these sort of more condensed, smaller blocks. So.
Okay.
And rooftops.
Tim, you had some good comments at the Design Commission just about rooftops and some of your history with working on.
Yeah, thanks. And that, and this is something we talked about a little bit at Design Commission. I realize you all don't see a lot of the rooftop conversations we have with the RF installations. And a lot of that is an interesting balance of what, to the point of screening to the point of there's more screening and now it's more obvious. The technology is a line of sight driven technology. So for instance, the further back the RF antennas are on a rooftop, the taller they get on the rooftop in order to reach the lines of sight. So that is a dilemma and inherent struggle we have all the time. You may, if you look closely on some brick parapeted buildings, some antennas hanging right on top of the cornice. That's the best location. So we struggle architecturally, historic preservation, mounting attachments, the stuff that gets bolted onto brick facades or other historic facades to try and hide that equipment outside of building walls, hence back on the roof. But we always have that back and forth. The best location to serve is on these catenary poles or on these streetlights where there's without obstruction. And then arguably a more of an opportunity to stealth that utility versus trying to stealth the utility on a building. For instance, fake brick with an antenna behind it.
They also have interior, like inside building installations too, that are behind windows. Correct? Is that in a couple of situations where
the one I love to point to, though it's easy to see, it was the dilemma itself. There's a couple of the public services parking garage. We've done a couple where the antenna arrays are actually stuffed within the framed window opening with the parking behind it. And then the interesting debate we had during our land use review process was, well, what color should it be? Black, you know, or when the garage is on, then it's backlit. And then in that instance, though, it did provide an opportunity for all the associated equipment to go into a parking space and leased out and so on. And so that's a little bit of a different animal. But that was for one antenna array for one utility provider that needs three angles to capture the satellite signal to provide. I mean, it is a dilemma to locate these things on architecture, much less the face of architecture. And there's few and far opportunities in between. The one other example I have for you is, which worked out great, but we don't have a lot of them, is Pioneer Square. If you look carefully, next time you're getting your triple mocha latte at the Starbucks at Pioneer Square, and you look at the nest of screening that's on top of that small building, you can look closely and you'll see some antennas. And they are tucked and pushed in that area. It also is in the middle of a wide open city block and provides service very well, but is few and far between an opportunity we have throughout the city, especially with our corridors.
What about fake street trees? You know how they have the...
Like,
that was a joke.
So, like every Christmas, it won't even be fake, it'll be real. It's just come down, you lose your service, your bars.
So I have another, question really for you about standardization and also about trying to create more than one use. I mean, part of your... You know, part of where PBOT is going with this, which I think is probably a great idea, is trying to not have single-use poles scattered throughout Central City, especially if there's, you know, if we're adding 2,400 new poles, but, you know, potentially. So would you be developing kind of these prototypes that have a fair amount of standardization? And I guess I'm assuming right now that we're moving past the idea of trying to sort of replicate or make a faux historic. I'm talking about sort of a more sleek standard pole that, you know, perhaps wouldn't be in a historic district or whatever. So would those have various uses that they could provide? So for instance, you'd look at one that could provide both a street sign use and a light. And then you'd look at another model that could provide, you know, I don't know. There are so many poles and uses and elements already in our streetscape. I guess I just want to hear from you how you would go about that, especially since you might have three providers who are all jostling for the same street corner.
So my understanding of, and that's why we are working with a third party to do what we're calling the wireless master plan. So there will be an inventory of all the poles. then we will release X amount of poles, and we'll say, and so we'll do a radio frequency study because all the carriers have different radio frequencies, and you know where people need to be, right? And they'll start applying, almost like the way you do StubHub tickets, right? So they'll be able to go in and start applying for which pole, which locations they want. Part of the agreement that they'll have with us in the lease agreement that they will sign, the sublease agreement, will have requirements. So they will be, we won't be adding 2,400 poles. We will potentially be replacing up to, depending on where we are, 2,400 poles. So yes, one could say that, and we haven't sort of gotten past there, right? The first step was, you know, years ago I worked in BDS, so I tapped my friends Tim and Karen, said, hey, you know what? We might want to get out in front of this, because we would hate for folks to either have something shut, you know, where you had no ability to comment, and just hear about, you know, like, I think at first everyone thought we would replace it with faux poles. It's been interesting to hear that, no, we don't want faux pole. I mean, we don't want to really have to remove them at all, but if they need to be removed, absolutely don't put a faux pole. And that's great feedback. We haven't gotten to the next step of how much multi-use. What we do know is that, for example, we, the city, PBOT, are doing a lot with Vision Zero around the speed safety cameras, right? And we also know that with the climate action plan, there's a lot going on with air quality, right? Especially what went on over, you know, the other side of the river, just matching what's going on with air quality. So those are things that we're interested in. We're also putting in some traffic sensors on some Cobra heads out on the east side. So knowing that we have needs, wouldn't it be great if we're replacing these poles with the ability to multi-use them? So you might not be able to put two radio antennas on small cells, but that's not to say that we couldn't attach a climate sensor to one of these poles. And again, it needs to have enough conduit, so enough infrastructure to be able to power it, and then the strength to be able to hold it. And hopefully we would shroud it. We would be able to have the shrouding in a way that would hide as much as possible, and maybe require the volts in the ground, right? So past that, we honestly haven't looked to, do we have one, two, three, or four different versions of what we're looking at? But yes, we would have requirements, and then the carriers just, they would then comply with those requirements.
Can I offer one cautionary note about the pole replacement as we look at this photo here? They may not want to replace all the poles, and so, I'm just throwing this out there. And so, in this case, if they're only replacing one pole, is it better to replace it with one that matches all the other poles, or should that one pole be the modern light? Because I might argue in this situation, if you know, if eight poles are going to stay the old cast iron ones, and they're not really old, they're...
But it doesn't look anything like it. It's got that random thing in the middle.
Right.
It's going to look different no matter what. It's going to look a bastardization of the historic, and I don't know. I would say...
It's a continuity thing where I worry that you're actually... And if it was... It could be done. I'm throwing it out as just a caution that...
Well, is there an opportunity for a win out of this in terms of... I mean, if some of these do need to get just replaced, is there an opportunity to put them somewhere in a more historic area of the city? And maybe that there's some kind of compensatory mitigation that's built into the franchise agreement so that if in fact that does happen, then the city is compensated and it can be placed in an area that maybe we do want to accentuate the historical.
I would say that as part of the survey, it's really critical that you guys, I don't know how you would do it, but to sort of have an understanding when it was built, what the configuration is, come up with this as a one type versus another type, so maybe you end up having 10 historic streetlight types. So I think that what I'm hearing is, or what we're hearing is, it's replacement. We're not adding. It's not additive. It's replacing, either with a, most likely with something contemporary looking. But I guess as you make this argument, it's really important to know what's being replaced, where it's being replaced, what the age of it is. And I think that would really help an argument, and then you can start identifying, well, that's really very old, it's original, and there may be ones that aren't original, we don't know at this point, it wouldn't be that much of a heartache, but it would really help for us to understand, you know, what is being replaced and what is the value. So that would just be really critical. Mm-hmm. That's part of an inventory. And is that something that would mean adding a historian to the team, I mean, of doing the inventory? I don't know, maybe already you have that information. I don't know.
I, I don't, I mean, I can work with Tim and staff to find out what we know about. I mean, we could, we already have the inventory of the ornamental poles. Mm-hmm. I know we have those at PBOT because I think when we purchase them or receive them from the utilities is how we, why we have that inventory. And I can see what we know between that and working with staff here to see, like someone mentioned that there are, you know, specific poles, like let's say.
There's, I think, three in Old Town.
Right. So, I mean, right, you know, by, we could absolutely figure out where some of these, like see how many they are, where are they, maybe, you know, I mean, not every single pole is going to be, you know what I mean? And I mean, so absolutely we can. And again, like I said, we're not going to, the intent is not to start with these. And I have, as I have walked through the city over the last 6 months downtown and realized that there are not, I celebrate every Cobra head I find, you know, but there just aren't very many Cobra heads. You know, I celebrate everyone I find because I'm like, there's another one. Right. But, you know, yes, things are going to start happening. And we've even looked at, you know, some of these, like this has already happened, right? This is in Portland. So could that catenary that's already on that pole be turned into, I don't know, but we could look at that, right? It's already modified. So could we use those, right? So absolutely we'll take into account. I didn't know there were poles that some of them that were historically marked. So we'll absolutely identify those. And maybe there is a way that we can say, you know, we're not going to touch these. There's seven of them or whatever it is, or 10 or 20. And
I
start that.
I'm very, I mean, I don't know where you guys are all at, but everything that they're doing is to reduce the visual pollution of all this stuff. And when we looked at the images of, so even the worst, if this is the worst, it's still way better than the pictures we saw of the California installations. So I guess my final thought on the faux versus not full, it's more about just reducing the amount and number of these visual things that are everywhere. I think, you know, it seems like we live in a place where there's more poles than we need. So,
and I would also just hopefully encourage all of you, if there are ideas about, you know, if we do end up going down the path and they're removed, you know, I always think about the LACMA exhibit where they have the straight poles in front of the museum, which has clearly already been done once. But I mean, if there are things we can do with these poles, whether they get repurposed as light, some anyway, that would be also something for discussion.
Okay. So what I'm hearing is that we should probably prepare a letter that kind of highlights some of the things that we've heard, such as inventory, you know, establishment of the priorities, and at least in our mind, of how best to accommodate new facilities within the city, and if it involves a replacement of an existing historic light, and then also the desire to not have these kind of mounted boxes to even a new installation, I think, would not be preferable. So I think we should be as specific as possible in terms of saying really what our desire is for this type of programming. And it would be great to have a report back, too, in terms of, you know, we want this to, I think, to be a dialogue over the long term of how this program is implemented and how the franchisees are receiving some of these recommendations from the city, because I think that would be an ideal situation for us, at least.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'll just add to that a little bit. I would completely agree with Chair Renzetta that strapping more items, especially sort of boxy, various shaped items to existing poles seems less preferable. I mean, I totally understand that you would like to use existing infrastructure where possible, but I also think that we need to be looking at sort of standards for size, shape, location, you know, for some of that stuff. And without that, we have the, you know, we're going to be looking at this stuff for a really long time. I mean, I appreciate some of the things that you're doing, such as making sure that all the vaults are going to go underground. I really applaud that. And if there's a way that we can if there's a way that we can look at some of those more congested areas where you were saying, you know, some of these locations don't even have room underground, perhaps there is a way to lease space, you know, from a nearby building owner, you know, make those happen so that they don't proliferate in our right of ways. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I would really like to see a replacement pole standard or a couple of standards come forward and be developed as a piece of our infrastructure that, you know, we're not just relying on this pole here and this random sort of size here.
Okay. All right. Summarize a couple quick comments. I'm glad to hear the commission would be willing to put together a letter. One, I want to make sure you reference aspects of the Design Commission summary letter that you received more recently from the March 1st hearing. I think I've heard a lot of similarities in a lot of the concerns they raise. Commission drilled in particularly on the twin ornamentals, and so I want to, before we walk out today, I want to get a look, see if there's some consensus on to bedazzle the twin ornamentals or just leave them alone. And I think that's helpful moving forward because time is of the essence, and if there's some synergy between the commissions, it would be nice to know that. So I want to be clear on the language that we're using because we are referring to lots of different kinds of vertical infrastructure. The Design Commission was very supportive of finding a quote-unquote replacement all utility pole, which could include lighting, could include parking meters or what have you, as well as the RF. The Design Commission was particularly averse to replicating the twin ornamentals, particularly because they cannot be replicated in the same way that they are now, and spent a lot of time talking about that kind of the detail, the craft, the quality, the scale, the parts and pieces of it were what made it an ornamental. I see nodding heads, but I just want to understand, because Matthew brought up a really good point, is if one of a series of twin ornamentals gets replaced by, say, a new and improved version of the standard, that will break some continuity on some street fronts. And so I just want to I want to hear a little more from the commissioners' concerns on that or where that might go.
Isn't that already happening, though? Isn't there a new twin ornamental being put up every day on new projects?
It's to the same design, though.
But the specs.
Exactly. I mean, yeah. Is it?
I don't think that. I mean, think a lot of them are newer. They're newer light bulbs. I mean, they're most.
I mean,
of
you
them
can
are,
look at the PBOT street standards, you know, and see. There may be some slight differences. Yes.
Out of 1890. I mean.
Yeah. Oh, Annie, are you thinking there's some nuances within it, or is it an overall scale?
I mean,
scale?
There's infrastructure required in those that wasn't, you know, back when the originals were made. So I just question that, you know, it seems like we're already replacing those, or we have a light pole that is replicating a historic fabric. So I just don't want to go down the path of, well, then it's okay for us to continue to do it, especially as the infrastructure is changing and is going to be changing again. So then we're stuck with something.
And I'll add, in some cases, there's not a historic building in any proximity to any of the old light fixtures because the neighborhoods have changed so much. I mean, the one image we were just looking at, it's all modern construction. So anyway.
Yeah, I mean.
I want to have some visual consistency and I want it to be thought of holistically. And I think, you know, sometimes, no offense to engineers and you know, technical people, but they aren't necessarily sitting back and going, well, what is the streetscape going to look like when I'm done? And it's just cleaning it up so it's not so cluttered.
Are we saying that we are pro the... Can we go back to that one picture where we had the historic and the new with the pole and the big base?
I mean, there's not a historic building.
Because, I mean, this one... You know, they also had to up the base, looks completely different.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe to your average bypasser who really is not, you know, you're looking at it out of the corner of your eyes. I mean, you're not staring at every single detail. I mean, maybe I would, but your average person wouldn't maybe not notice. But I would say that they're, you know, they look completely different. And
my understanding is the globes get bigger too, mm-hmm. right? They get bigger because they hold equipment in them.
Mm. So they're going to be sort of, it's not going to look the same. I mean, I don't know. But
my preference would just be to separate the two uses. Like, if you need to replace one of these guys, then just replace it with something different. Otherwise, just leave them alone.
I totally agree. There's no need to sort of go with some new version of these ornamental lights, because A, they're not going to match, the historic ones throughout the city, and B, they're just going to be ugly.
Right. And I think what we're asking is to prioritize those that are close to historic existing National Register or local landmarks or in districts. Again, we're talking about a fairly small percentage of the city where that would be apparent. But I think the historic environments are the thing around those resources are what we, I think, care most about.
Yeah, and I would say if one does have to get removed, that it be, salvaged, repaired, and kept so that when the day comes, the technology is small enough to fit inside, it can get replaced.
I agree.
Yeah, me too. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for indulging us some additional conversation, because I just want to make sure we've discussed it, because no one's going to come back for the design review of where these poles go. They're just going to appear. And so it's
right. And if as a secondary note, you could look at these things in a neighborhood scale and it become some item of neighborhood character, then I think all the better.
Well, would we have the opportunity to review if it goes into a historic neighborhood?
Yeah.
If they're going to replace 10 of them in the ABC district or something, I don't know.
One of the reasons why we're here is having one, this is obviously a very educative briefing on what's happening, what's coming down the road. but it also has to do with what are the next steps. And so what I'm hearing is concern around twin ornamentals. Fine. We need to work the problem and with PBOT relative to what the timing of these regulations are. We're under quite a short timeline. When it comes to establishing a new standard, part of what PBOT's going to be looking for is commissioner, both design and landmarks commission, depending on districts that they're in, is some sense of recommendation, obviously, ideally for approval. And that's kind of where the tough conversation here is around, there's some objects in the right-of-way, like Cobra Heads, or street signals that have really it's purely utilitarian, and there's more wiggle room there to do stealth, per se, not strapped on, but stealth. It was around the twin ornamentals that we really kind of had a spinner of a conversation with the design commission, and I'm hearing similar thoughts. I think as we get closer, if there is going to be a redesign, how we manage that in more sensitive areas like historic districts or in historic character areas, maybe there's two standards. I don't know. I think that's part of what we're here today, and I think we'll be coming back. What I do want to get out of one of you, or at least a tentative commitment, is a liaison to this project. Right now, Commissioner Tad Savinar with the Design Commission has thrown his hat in the ring. What that will do for us and for PBOT is save the time of coordinating you all for a more formal briefing so we can have more of an internal huddle and then report back to our respective commissions. I think that, given the time constraints, that's going to be really helpful.
Yeah, that'd be great.
So if anyone wants to throw their hat in now,
do I hear any
you can do that. Otherwise, I will harass you all week long.
I'll volunteer.
Okay.
Cool.
Thank you, Annie.
Thanks,
Annie. Thank you,
Annie.
Anybody
else?
Great. And then do we have a volunteer for the letter by any chance? Would anyone?
I can take a stab at it. I've been taking notes, and maybe I can circulate it to a subgroup.
Yeah, a subgroup. Do I have any other? Ernestina, do you want to take a shot just at maybe reviewing something from?
Okay.
Okay. And then is anyone else interested?
I'm happy to help out too, yeah.
Great. Okay. We have our three. Awesome. All right, well, thank you very much again for that presentation, and we'll definitely get back to you, and hopefully it's the beginning of a longer dialogue as we move forward. Thank you. The next thing on our agenda, we are